This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we ask reporters here in Northwest Indiana Media to join us on the program to give us an update on the stories that they have put out in print and online. And we have now with us talking about some of the big news coming out of Indianapolis these days and probably for several more days ahead. It's dealing with the political boundary redistricting, and that means we're calling on Dan Carton, who is the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, to talk about it. And Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, it's an interesting topic, and it's been covered even before the state Republicans decided to make the maps that were they've at least created and probably will turn out to be the ones that will be adopted in reality this past week here. But bring us up to date first about just briefly about the redistricting process and what the General Assembly is dealing with now.
Sure. This is something the General Assembly does every 10 years after the U.S. Census to, in effect, rebalance all of the legislative districts to ensure they have the same number of people in each one. You know, people move around, people move to the state, people leave cities. So to ensure that everybody has an equal voice in the state legislature and in the U.S. House, this redistricting process is done where they redraw all the district boundaries in new ways to ensure at the base equal population, and then other factors often come into consideration, things like communities of interest, sometimes political considerations. So it's an interesting process for sure.
I guess that's an easy way to put it. I guess it's much more complex than that, obviously. And your stories, the Times focused as well on not only the generalities and they have up until now, but you also go into more of the specifics and what kind of impact this is likely to have on Northwest Indiana. You spent a lot of time and you got the graphics people busy going through things to come up with some interesting maps and the like to show how the new congressional districts will change. Change the face of politics, perhaps, or maybe not, here in Northwest Indiana. Will you tell us more about that?
Sure. The first congressional district with Representative Frank Mervan doesn't actually change that much. This was a communities of interest move to protect Northwest Indiana as sort of a unique place within the state. So the first district, the proposed new first district, would be all of Lake County, all of Porter County, and sort of the northwest corner of LaPorte County, like starting in the city of LaPorte and then up through Michigan City and over to the lake. That's mostly what the district is now. It's been all of Lake and all of Porter County since 2011, and then sort of a western slice of LaPorte County, including Michigan City and the rest of the lake shore. This just, sort of adjusts that a bit. The first district needed to pick up about 25,000 residents to meet the what's called the ideal number, and based on the population of the state, the new population of the state. So it was just sort of a little bit of tweaking up here. Some of the bigger changes downstate were in the 5th congressional district in the northern suburbs of Indianapolis. That area has been trending Democratic, and the Republican-controlled General Assembly has changed that district to make it more Republican. So it probably would be less. I mean, a Democrat hasn't won the 5th district in all of the last decade. It might, someone might have in the next few years if it didn't change, but it looks like the Republicans are trying to solidify that as a Republican district. And it is one of the fastest growing districts in the state, so it had to change, and then the districts around it had to change too. So it's like I said, it is a complicated process because you're, especially at the congressional level, you have to have exactly equal population in all 9 congressional districts. So it's pretty tricky to put together these kinds of maps.
And I know that the data that you've taken a look at here, that obviously the Indiana Republicans out of Indianapolis have done their best to try to be sure to keep at least one congressional district solidly Republican by adding more counties and more precincts into that area too.
Yeah, and basically it looks like the state is going to stay roughly seven Republican districts, two Democratic districts. The Republican districts have enough people, except in, a political disaster year for Republicans, that they would probably stay Republican. Indianapolis in the 7th district is almost certain to always stay Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And then up here in Northwest Indiana, there has been some suggestion that it's trending more Republican. I think people are overreading that, because you had in 2020 a first-time congressional candidate. When Congressman Mervan replaced Congressman Visglossi, he led the district for 36 years, and a Republican presidential candidate that was unusually popular with union members.
Yeah. We've spoken so far about how the congressional districts are shaping up here. Let's talk a little bit about the Indiana districts in particular. What kind of impact the changes in the maps are going to mean for Northwest Indiana? How are things going to shape up as far as the Indiana House of Representatives is concerned?
Right. And radio is really the best venue to speak about maps. But
you can't really describe maps on
right.
the radio very well, but we'll do the best we can, I know.
Yeah. I would say State Representative Hale Slager pointed out that especially in Lake County, as the population is gradually moving out of the northern cities, Hammond, Chicago, and Gary, moving more to the south, and you're getting more Illinois people in South Lake County, you have to adjust the maps to account for, a growing population in St. John and Schererville and Winfield, Crown Point. So the districts in Northwest Indiana haven't changed all that much, but they have somewhat moved south to better account for where everybody is living now. And you see similar things in Porter County. If you get down to the much more granular level, a lot of the districts now somewhat overlap municipal boundaries. And that just is going to happen sometimes, because you have to try and get 67,000 people in each district.
Right.
And it's a tricky process. But the new maps appear to have done a better job of keeping cities and towns intact. So the new 12th district will be Munster, Highland, and Griffith, whereas Griffith now is currently split in three different ways, because that was where they were grabbing the extra people for to finish off the districts in 2011.
Right.
So it seems to do a little bit better keeping municipalities intact compared to the current maps.
Now, from what we have right now, since these are still, I guess, officially just proposed maps, but I'm sure that they'll probably make them more official in time. But how is this going to impact the incumbent Democrats, particularly up in Northlake County?
I don't think it'll change that much.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't seen the Senate maps. The Senate maps are going to come out. The Indiana Senate maps are going to come out next week. I think they were still working on them. So, but in Northlake County, the districts are still relatively the same. You got a Hammond-Whiting district, a East Chicago, West Gary district, and sort of a Gary-Hobart, New Chicago district. And that's kind of what they're at right now. And they all go just a little bit farther south. So I wouldn't expect to see many changes there. The 19th district, which is Representative Altoff's district in Crown Point, is going to go more into Porter County. So that probably solidifies it for Republicans. It's always been an interesting – the 19th has flipped back and forth a few times in the last 10 years. Between Democrats and Republicans, based on how the vote in Lakes of the Four Seasons turned out, because it was a sort of a Crown Point district, and the Democrats could pile up votes in the Lake County portion of the district, and then the Lakes of the Four Seasons votes would come in, and they would be more Republican than Democratic, and that would decide the race. And now, going forward, it's going to be there's going to be more of Porter County in there. It's going to be sort of a half Lake County, half Porter County, and that'll probably make it more certain for Republicans. But
Well, you mentioned,
you never know.
Yes, that's very true. And you mentioned a moment ago about the fact that, of course, we now have the congressional district maps that have been released. We have the House district maps that have been released. And you say the Senate maps will come out next week. What's the rest of the timetable for getting not only the rest of the maps have been proposed out to take a look at, and any kind of public information sessions that are going to be held? I know there was one held this week, but nobody seemed to learn very much. Is that right. likely to yeah. happen again next week?
Yeah, there's actually one going on right now that I stepped out of to speak with you. But, so the House Elections Committee held hearings yesterday and today. The Senate Elections Committee is going to hold hearings next week. The full House is expected to vote on the bill, vote on the redist. So this has to pass as a bill, just like anything else that would go through the legislature. The full House is expected to vote on it next Thursday, I believe, and then the Senate will vote on it the week after that. And then the maps will go to the governor and be signed into the law. And by early October, we should have new legislative districts for the 2022 election.
Okay. One of the other stories you had out in print and online, too, involves Indiana legislature, legislative leaders at least, and what they have to say about trying to deal with the funding for school districts that are being affected by COVID-19. Will you bring us up to that story, please?
Yeah, this has been an issue the last couple years, obviously. Indiana has a law so the state of Indiana pays 100% of the instructional costs for most students and all students attending in-person classes at public schools, charter schools, students with vouchers, that's a little bit different. But public and charter schools, the state pays 100% of the instructional costs. They only pay 85% of instructional costs for students attending virtual schools. This is obviously during COVID, a lot of schools went virtual for a period, and this actually threatened some of their funding, because if students were considered virtual students instead of in-person students, then the school only would have gotten 85% of the money that they normally would get, or that they expected or budgeted for. So that's a pretty big problem for the school. So last year they did a fix for that the first time around, and it is some people think it's going to be an issue again this year, because some students were quarantined leading up to last Friday's student count date, just based on school district policies. And some school district leaders were concerned that if the state saw that these students had been attending classes virtually for the first 3 or 4 weeks of school, that they'd be considered virtual students for the entire semester, which would reduce the amount of money the school district gets from the state. The legislative leaders have said that they're going to fix that when they get back into session in January and make sure that the virtual, non-virtual distinction is based on an entire semester of attendance rather than just a few weeks leading up to the student count date.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories that you had too, Dan, we should bring up here when we have a chance to talk, is about the new word coming out from the Indiana Supreme Court about a statewide task force to help try to deal with a surge of evictions that Hoosiers are facing these days, all because of the pandemic. Will you tell us more about what the Indiana Supreme Court has in mind?
Sure. I mean, as a lot of people know, the federal eviction moratorium recently expired. That's been in place throughout most of the pandemic, that prevented people who had lost their jobs or who were, homesick due to the pandemic from being evicted from their apartments if they couldn't pay their rents. Now that this has expired, obviously landlords are moving to evict people who haven't been paying their rents. The Supreme Court, all those evictions go through the legal system, through the court system. The Supreme Court is concerned about what's going to happen to all these people who are getting evicted from their homes with nowhere to go, and they didn't have the money to pay their rent at their old place, they're probably not going to have the money to rent a new place. So the Supreme Court has created this task force to try and find ways of better distributing federal rental assistance money. There's a ton of this federal rental assistance money, but it's been just slow to get out to the people who need it, the residents and the landlord. And Chief Justice Loretta Rush thinks, it created this task force to say, like, look, let's find ways of getting this money out there, because it doesn't make sense to evict all these people from their homes if there's just money sitting on the sidelines that could be used to keep them in there. So she created this task force that includes a Lake County magistrate, Kathleen Bazilski, who does evictions in the Lake Superior Court. They're charged with reporting back in 35 days with basically how to fix this eviction issue and maybe keep more Hoosiers in their homes.
Well, that's another series of stories that'll be coming out here soon on that too. And Dan, thank you for bringing us up to date on these that have gone out already. And we'll look forward to more about the Supreme Court's task force dealing with evictions. Thanks for being with us today.
Anytime.
That's Dan Carton. He's the chief political reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. We're continuing on with our Reporters Roundtable Thursday, talking with Bill Dolan, who's a correspondent for The Times. He focuses in mainly on federal court stories, but there's a story here that we're going to find out more about that's come out recently of a case now in federal court in Hammond, but it has a lot of local implication because he's been privy in his past work as the former Lake County government reporter in watching a lot of Lake County government issues involving property tax sales, in particular the ones that the county commissioners put out every single year. First off, Bill, thanks for joining us back on Regionally Speaking again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, fill us in on what you know about how these matters involving property tax sales come about from your experience as a county government reporter, and how it fits in with this particular case that has just popped up and from a grand jury indictment from a federal court in Hammond.
Lake County holds tax sales at least two a year, both the Lake County Treasurer and the commissioners. And what is a tax sale? There are a lot of properties in Lake County where the owners aren't paying the property taxes. And a lot of these are in the city of Gary, where decades of blight have essentially left thousands of derelict houses, buildings, commercial sites, and just plain overgrown parcels of land that nobody's using it, and they're not paying taxes. And of course, Lake County depends on those taxes to run its operations. So when a parcel is billed over a two-year period and nobody pays the taxes, they put it on what's called the tax sale list. And there are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these parcels that are put up on auction, usually between September and February of every year. They essentially ask the public, we've got all this land. Some of it has buildings on it. Some of it is just, overgrown with weeds. If you want it, bid on it.
Right.
And that's in the case at court, a gentleman by the name of Sergio Gutierrez owned at least four parcels in a part of Gary that is was essentially empty, overgrown lots, now features a $300 million casino, the newly opened Hard Rock Casino. Mm-hmm. Mr. Gutierrez mm-hmm. happened to own this property before the casino was built. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't paying the taxes on these properties, like many, because they're... there's just no business opportunity to make money off of this property or to live on it. So he was letting the taxes go delinquent, and he is now accused in federal court of essentially having other individuals bid on these properties when they came up for auction. The county does not allow the delinquent tax owner to bid on his own properties for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be paying their taxes. In this case, about $22,000 worth of taxes back in 2015 and in 2018. But they will allow others to bid on it. And in this case, Mr. Gutierrez is accused of hiring what are called straw buyers, people who aren't connected with the owner, at least on paper, and then they bid on the property, get it, and then they turn it back over to the owner, who couldn't have bid on it himself.
I understand Mr. Gutierrez is pretty much banned now by the county commissioners and the county auditor's office from being involved in any of these tax sales, I guess because, like you mentioned, he isn't paying the delinquent taxes. He's buying the properties up, and he's just hanging on to them. And so that got him in trouble with the county to begin with. So he's not supposed to be buying any of these things anymore anyway. But how is he managing to get himself into trouble with the feds, as they say, in the same kind of purchase deal?
Essentially, a federal grand jury has alleged in its indictment that he defrauded Lake County government of $22,000 in property tax.
Okay, mm-hmm.
Those were the taxes that were assessed against four parcels of land in the 2700 block of Calhoun and Dallas Street. Those are lots that are just south of the Borman Expressway. And just west of Burr Street, which, of course, now is the site of this Hard Rock Casino. And he didn't pay the taxes. Well, if you owe taxes, then you can't go to a tax sale. That's just, you know, a hard and fast rule.
Yeah.
Because what happens is, if nobody else bids on them, you could get your land back for as little as $500 a parcel. And if you could have owned thousands of dollars in taxes, you can buy it back at a huge discount of $500. Well, the county doesn't want to give that discount. They want those taxes paid. So Mr. Gutierrez was banned from going to the tax sale and bidding on these properties. But he got around that by assigning other people to go and bid on them on his behalf. Once they got the properties, they gave it back to him. So he essentially washed off $22,000 in property tax bills for the cost of a few hundred dollars per parcel.
I understand, too, that the grand jury, when they were looking into this and they issued they handed down the indictment, they also mentioned that Mr. Gutierrez apparently was taking, with his scheme, taking advantage of being able to cover things up because of getting other people to like officially buy the properties, even though they turned, as you mentioned, turned it back over to him. But he mentioned it to help cover up the trail, I said, or trying to at least, wasn't he?
Right. When you successfully bid on a property in a tax sale, there are many legal steps that you have to accomplish before they give you the deed to the property. And he had other people do it in their name. Therefore, if you saw the legal paperwork, it wouldn't have had Mr. Gutierrez's name on it. It would have had somebody else's name on it. So there would be no alarms going off that this guy is buying back his own property. That's part of the alleged scheme to cover up what he was doing.
So it looks like that Mr. Gutierrez had the properties there in the area, the Black Oak neighborhood, where, of course, now the casino is now standing.
Yes.
And he had a chance to buy up the properties, which he's not supposed to do legally, turn it over to, I guess, or sell it back, I guess, to the company or some company. I guess the indictment doesn't name specifically, but you did some research into that and found out about it.
Yeah. Prior Times reporters have reported that a real estate acquisition firm hired by the casino when they were trying to buy the land up for the footprint of the casino was paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to acquire the land around this location between Burr and Calhoun and Dallas Street.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently Mr. Gutierrez profited from those sales by about $675,000. The federal government would like to make him forfeit that real estate profit.
Right. So it'll be interesting to see if the matter does actually go to court, because we know now the indictment's just been handed down, and it's going to follow through. The U.S. Attorney's Office is going to do its best to follow the case on through, and we may have a court appearance sometime in the future, I would imagine, and we'll hopefully have
it's set for trial in November. That's mm-hmm. probably too early. These things generally tend to take a year or more for preparations to everybody's ready to stand before a jury and present their case.
Right.
But the speedy trial law requires that a date be set in November, but that's likely to be continued.
Well, we'll just have to see how this all shapes up here when Mr. Gutierrez and or his attorneys show up in court to answer to the charges against him, and we'll continue on to find out what happens on this case in the future. And Bill Dolan, thank you very much for spending time bringing this up to date and on this particular case, and I guess we'll have to wait and see maybe in some court appearances whether this will have any impact on what the Hard Rock Casino might have to say about the property that they're now located on. Thank you very much for spending time with us to go over your story from the Times recently here.
My pleasure.
Bill Dolan's correspondent for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we talk with reporters here in Northwest Indiana Media about the stories they put out in print, online, or however way they do it, to tell people about what they've been covering. And in particular, we're talking about action from the Lake County Council. And starting out on that, we will talk with the reporter who covers the Lake County Council for the Post Tribune, Alex Kukulka. Alex, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the big stories had, of course, everybody's interested in finding out what is happening with the pandemic and, of course, with the surge of COVID-19 cases in Lake County, boosting all the problems and, in particular, concerns about children in school these days. One of the things I know was discussed was a request by the Lake County Health Officer to put out a mask mandate, but the county council wasn't going to go along with that. Tell us a little bit about some of the ideas behind the request and what the council did.
So on Tuesday, the Lake County Council voted 5-2 against a school mask mandate that County Health Officer Dr. Vavi Lala approved.
Mm-hmm.
And her mask order would have required students from kindergarten to 12th grade in all Lake County schools, be that public, private, others, to wear a mask while in class. And the reason she had to create the order was because there's a new state law that states that if a county health officer wants to put something that's stricter than Governor Holcomb's executive orders related to the pandemic, that order now needs to be considered by the council. So that's why they were discussing and voting on it on Tuesday.
Was there much controversy, so to speak, or at least opposition to the idea of creating the mandate? And of course, we know there's a state law that would require the county council to take up the matter, not just just simply an edict from a health officer.
There was a lot of opposition at the meeting on Tuesday. Dozens of people were inside the meeting room and even outside, and 18 people spoke before the vote was held. And before the vote was held, Councilman Al Menchaca stated that he was going to vote in support of the mask mandate, given the number of emails and calls he got from his constituents asking him to support it. But then ultimately he changed his vote to a no vote.
Mm-hmm.
After listening to the 18 people who were sharing information that is misinformation, to put it frankly, and could be debunked. And so that's how the vote ended up changing a bit.
What did some of the residents that were at the meeting have to say to the county council about the concerns, especially of the fact that youngsters could contract the virus? And some have, of course, they're in many cases are in quarantine because of it. What did some of the residents in the region that attended the meeting have to say about that?
Yeah, so Mary Henderson of Crown Point said that children can't spread the virus and that wearing a mask far outweighs what the like impacts of COVID, which we know is disproved by the CDC. And as you mentioned, students are contracting the virus in schools. As we speak, I know the first week of school alone, just in Lake County, thousands of students were in quarantine after being exposed to the virus. And I know as of Monday, there was nearly 5,000 new cases reported among students, a little over 250 for teachers, and roughly 400 for staff members. So the virus is definitely in the schools. Health professionals have been urging the council to sort of take action because masks is a sure way to protect them.
We're talking with Alex Kukulka, who covers Lake County government news for the Post-Tribune, about the latest Lake County Council meeting. They've took up the issue about a request for a mask mandate, which they turned down. But they've also taken up some matters, and at least by a certain vote, were able to get through on one request in particular. And that was a request from Lake County Sheriff to get a new boat. Will you tell us some of the background about that and some of the discussion that came up before the vote was taken?
So the sheriff is looking to use or spend $770,000, a little more, to buy a new boat for his department. And so the issue here is the money is available in a public safety fund, but there's no like line item in the budget. So the council first had to approve creating the new item in the budget, like the line item, and then transferring or moving the money over.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been discussing and working on that. And I know, as you mentioned, the line item passed and sort of the transfer, but Councilman Charlie Brown has voiced opposition to this from the beginning, because this has been discussed for roughly 3 months now. Because he feels he has not received enough information about the boat or the purchase. He said he didn't get information as to like why it's needed, how often it would be used, if additional staffing would be required to use the boat. So he's been the one who's been most strongly against the purchase from the beginning. And I do know the sheriff did say that he is requesting the boat because the department currently has two lifeboats or boats, I should say.
Right.
And they are aged. They're pretty old, especially the one that this new boat would replace. So that's what the sheriff's been saying for the reason for the boat.
I get the impression that Sheriff Martinez and his staff, in particular his executive staff, the ones that report directly to him, have done an awful lot of research into these kinds of boats. And they say that, I guess, that the average cost is like $1 million. So 700 some thousand is not an unlikely charge for this type of boat.
Yeah, that is correct. He was he mentions often that when they were doing research for this boat, the like biggest price tag was $1.5 million. So this boat would be nearly half that. He did also mention that it would take 8 to 12 months to build the boat and like get it all ordered. So this isn't something that, you know, snap of the finger, he gets it tomorrow.
Right.
So this is going to take time. So they are moving forward with transferring the money, but it's still going to take time to build the boat and get it to the county.
Right. You know, it's not unlike anything that involves law enforcement equipment. It always, if you have to make it specialized or customized for a particular department, it always takes a while for the manufacturer to get it to specs and get that thing made and delivered. So I'm not surprised to hear about that. Be sure. All this, of course, coming together because the Lake County Council is now in the midst of working on putting together the 2022 state county budget, and one of the things that the state insists on that they have some good discussion about these issues. Will you tell us first off some of the early discussions that the county council's had with its department heads about the items on the budget and what they are doing right now?
So last Tuesday and Thursday, the council held largely all day meetings.
Yeah.
And the last Tuesday was sort of an all-day sprint meeting where department heads would come in before the council just to let them know what they would like to see in their budget. Vast majority of the department heads asked for either a 3 or 5% raise for their staff. And then they would, you know, most people would ask for slight shifts in the budget. I know the prosecutor, he requested to be able to create two new positions in his department. Same with the Lake County Health Department. They wanted two new positions. So Tuesday was an all-day event of how the departments like to see the 2022 budget. And then last Thursday, the council met to sort of discuss what was presented and to formally get the budget planning process started by passing a bunch of motions. And the big exciting news of last Thursday was that the county received approval to increase tax-based funds by 4% for 2022. So they have a little bit of extra funds. It's actually roughly $5 million in funds to spend. But they saw a decrease from the 2021 budget in miscellaneous revenues. So Scott Schmall, the finance director, mentioned that a part of that $5 million is going to go to sort of offset those losses.
Mm-hmm. Is the county looking to get a lot of money from the federal government in some of the discussions already happening on Capitol Hill that they'll be able to do more things certainly into 2022, like repair more highways, do more work on other types of infrastructure in the county and things like that? So the departments are going to get a little extra funds maybe to do some of the work they've wanted to do this next year?
Yes, so Lake County is going to receive a little bit over $94.3 million in coronavirus local finance recovery funds. So they're definitely getting a big amount of money there. But when I talked to Finance Director Scott Schmall about it, he said that, you know, the county is definitely going to use the funds, but the challenge is sort of the guidelines in place.
Right.
Because the money can only be spent for, like, the public health response to address negative economic impacts, to replace lost public sector revenue, to provide premium pay for essential workers, things like that. So I did ask him if, like, for example, the 3-5% raise that department heads were asking for, if that could be covered with this fund. But he told me that would not be possible because that's like an annual raise, not specific to the pandemic. So they're going to have to think about how to best use the money, and they're starting that planning process now.
Now, Alex, how is the timetable work out now for people that may want to keep an eye on what the county council is doing concerning the governmental budget for 2022? When do they have the opportunity to get more information together? When do they actually have to make a decision on the budget before they have to send it off to the state for approval and review?
Yeah, so their next meeting is next Tuesday, the 21st, and that's going to be the first, like, reading of the budget and first initial approval of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then in early October, they're going to have the second reading on the budget before it's sent to the state in, like, mid-October or so.
Well, Alex, we'll be watching for the stories in the Post Tribune about all of this coming up here, and especially as we have more 2022 budget-related meetings coming up here this next week. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about the stories that are out there in print and online from some of the action that the Lake County Council has done this week for sure, and we'll look for more ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alex Kokolka is the Lake County Government Reporter for the Post Tribune. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. And our thanks to our guests from the Times and from the Post Tribune talking about the stories they've put out in print and online. And we'll be back with you on Monday.